the future has arrived. As the world and humanity itself moves faster and faster into unimaginable possibilities, old institutions that built connection and shaped our sense of meaning are falling by the wayside. In their wake, profound questions about ethics, our purpose, and spirituality demand new answers. Join your host, Scott Mason, in Season 2 of the Purpose Highway Podcast. We will explore how these social changes will revolutionize our society. We will learn how they impact our own search for connection and meaning. And we will hear stories of influencers whose lives have had radical change from the inside and found profound connection to others and themselves through a new definition of meaning. The future has arrived. Are you ready?
When you're racing down the purpose highway, we want to make sure you're healthy and happy every step of the way. That's why we're proud to partner with It's Nola, 21st century plant-based healthy granola snack bites made with real ingredients and audacious flavor. It's Nola crafts small batch hand-rolled granola balls that are vegan, gluten-free, and naturally low in sugar. It's Nola's delightful bites come in three flavors: luscious cranberry coconut, sassy mango masala, and dark, decadent, chewy chocolate. It's Nola is available to both individual customers and for wholesale accounts at itsnola.com. That's itsnola.com. Guests on this show are already enjoying this delicious snack. Check out It's Nola's website for yourself and find out how good it is. Hello, everybody. It's Scott Mason revving up for another race down the Purpose Highway. If you like what we're doing, be sure to subscribe and give us a thumbs up on YouTube or a positive review on Apple. Now, sitting next to me today in the front seat is Gregory Lopez. Gregory is the founder and facilitator of the New York City Stoics Meetup and co-founder and board member of the Stoic Fellowship. He's on the team for Modern Stoicism and co-facilitates the Stoic Camp in New York with the co-author of his book, A Handbook for New Stoics. In addition, he's the lead editor for Examine.com, a website that looks at the science behind various health and wellness matters and then distills them for general audiences. Gregory, we have a lot to talk about today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
I'm very excited. Gregory, before we get into the meat of this conversation, for the uninitiated, what exactly is Stoicism and how does it differ from the stereotype? Because I don't know about you, but when I first heard the word Stoics, I thought of some stone cold person walking around without any feelings or any emotions. That's not a positive stereotype. So what are Stoics and how do they differ from that?
Well, Stoicism is an ancient philosophy that came out of the Hellenistic period of ancient Greece after the time of Alexander the Great's death. And so Stoa just means porch, and that's because the philosophers were kind of teaching and having their school on a public porch where anybody can walk up. So this was a philosophy in order to try to live a good life, make a life and craft a life for yourself that is worth living. And philosophy during that time literally means love of wisdom. And it's somewhat drifted away from that. If you went to an academic department or picked up a philosophy journal nowadays, you're probably not going to learn about how to live a good life. But philosophy was designed for that initially in the Hellenistic time period. So Stoicism in particular is a specific philosophy that has a specific goal. And that goal is to be the best version of you that you could be, which involves trying to improve yourself morally and in other ways as well. It differs from some other Hellenistic philosophies, which also wanted to craft worthwhile lives in its goal. So the goal of some others said, like, well, good life is having enough physical pleasure. Yeah. That is the Cyrenaic school of philosophy. Another school, the Epicureans, who also have a different meaning to their term nowadays. But the original Epicureans wanted mental tranquility, and that was their goal. Stoicism wanted to make people the best versions of themselves and the best human beings they can be. Over time, this kind of craft, this changed into kind of suppressing emotions and trying to just keep a stiff upper lip and just gritting your teeth and going, I'm going to take it. And that is not what the practice of the philosophy of Stoicism is nowadays. Instead of repressing one's emotions, Stoics have a theory of how emotions arise. And the goal is to learn that theory, then constantly apply it in order to work with them actively, kind of like an Aikido versus just holding a person down. Like,
I love it. And thank you so much for that. Now, for those who might be listening or watching who are unfamiliar with some of the time frames that we're talking about, Hellenistic period, when was that in history? Like, was it AD, BC? When?
It was in the 300s BC up until the 30s-ish BC, I would say. So in the BC period.
All right. And one thing that is interesting that was embedded in what you said goes as to the origin of that name, porch. When I think about a porch, I have to say, I don't think about the ancient Greek porches because I can't even imagine what those might have looked like. But what I can imagine is my grandma's porch in Selma, Alabama. And she had one of these houses that had a porch up front with one of those swings on it. And the neighbors would just come and hang out and we'd watch the sun go down together. We'd have something to drink. Maybe some cigars would be smoked. Maybe some gossip would be had. And there'd be all sorts of fun stuff going on. And that sort of memory, for those of us who are of a certain age, now, I'm not that age. I'm only 26. However, for those that are older than me, and no, I'm not really 26, have really positive associations with that, because what it represented was a sense of real community. The date that this episode is being recorded is in January of 2022, which is during one of the waves of the COVID pandemic. So there has been a lot of physical separation, but we all know that technological advances, which you and I are going to discuss a lot more during this show, have really changed what community looks like and how people interact with each other. Going back to that term porch, there are two fundamental theses of this show that I wanted us to review for your sake as well as for anyone listening or watching. And then we're going to get into more deep conversations from your perspective about their implications with regards to Stoicism and the lives that we want to live. The first is the concept of the secret plague. And the secret plague is a hidden pandemic of alienation that a lot of data has shown has been exacerbated by the pandemic that's happening while we're recording this, but predated it. And I have a feeling that that alienation that people feel from a sense of community or from each other is not going to just mysteriously go away the second we're suddenly walking back and forth without lockdowns and masks and all of that. So the secret plague is almost antithetical to me to the concept of the porch that Stoicism got its name from. And I find that very interesting and worth contemplating as we have this conversation today. Secondly, I want to talk about the additional pillar of this season of Scott Mason's Purpose Highway, the silent revolution. The silent revolution is the decline in the governing authority, for lack of a better word, that a lot of the dominant religious traditions in the West and certain other parts of the world have had and are continuing to have over ethics, purpose, and spirituality. As I mentioned, the focus, because of where this podcast originates and where a lot of this study around the decline in religiosity has occurred, has been in the Western world, although there's a lot of data that similar shifts are occurring in other parts of the world too. The reason I mention the Western world in particular is that many, if not all, of the cultures that are experiencing this silent revolution in thinking are cultures that have been dominated by monotheistic traditions. All of these monotheistic traditions originally began more or less as either tribal or other highly localized religions, where the dominant god was basically the sponsor of that particular tribe. And then later the religion spread out either voluntarily or through conquest. Stoicism, on the other hand, as you mentioned, arose in ancient Greece and persisted also into the Roman era. And those were polytheistic traditions. In the case of Rome, it was a polytheistic tradition that was both multicultural and incorporated local and tribal deities into its pantheon all the time. Do you think, in light of what I just said about the Romans, that this cosmopolitan, highly diverse religious thinking milieu that the ancient Greek world, the Roman world were in, has any relevance as to why Stoicism is gaining popularity today?
I think it may have some relevance as to why it's gaining popularity today, specifically kind of the slow pullback that religion has played in people's lives over the years for various reasons that are very, very complicated. Mm-hmm. And I have some concept, but not too strong of a concept, but it seems to be like, you know, a lot of people are pulling away from it. I was given the option. I was raised mixed Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, because I'm half Puerto Rican and half Eastern European. And so I was given the option of getting confirmed in the Roman Catholic Church, and I chose not to. So it's a complicated matter. And the Stoics actually were very theistic in the early days, but they had kind of a different pantheistic view of what God is. But it did play an important part in early Stoicism. And there is a thread today in modern Stoicism of people who call themselves traditional Stoics who want to believe that holding on to this pantheistic view of seeing the universe as a living creature that has its own goals is important to Stoicism, and they find comfort in it. I can see that, although that's not the way I go. But I think it's interesting because there's a complex interplay of religion and philosophy in the ancient world, because religion wasn't, when I think of religion, I don't know how a lot of the world necessarily thinks of religion, but from the Western American-ish perspective, like, religion's actually pretty narrow, our concept of it, of this monotheistic God, as you said, who needs to be worshipped in a specific way. That kind of only applies to maybe Christianity and Islam, as far as I could tell, not even Judaism, because Judaism mixes in a whole bunch of ethnicity concepts along with that. And so I wouldn't even go say all of the Abrahamic religions. But yeah, I guess people are looking for ways to guide their lives and ways to form community in order to kind of counteract the silent plague that you mentioned. And I think that philosophy can play a large part in helping some people out with that, but maybe not the entire thing, I would think.
Talk to me a little bit about the relationship that you see between the rise of interest in Stoicism in particular as a philosophical approach that people might take in the absence of the decline of some of these religions, or as a general way of improving their lives, becoming better people, or providing some sort of ethical or day-to-day North Star, as opposed to, for instance, any other system that's out there. And I say that because Stoicism in particular has seen a rise in interest. A lot of these other Epicureanism, for instance, there aren't New York Times bestsellers being written about that philosophy right now. What do you think is the difference?
Part of it goes down to the kind of philosophy. Epicureanism is actually being spoken about a little bit more. There is a book called Tending the Epicurean Garden, which is about trying to bring Epicureanism to the modern world. But part of it is their goal. So Epicureans want peace of mind as their ultimate goal. And Stoicism wants people to become a better person. So there are different kind of things to do. And so if you take a look at an ideal Epicurean life, that would entail maybe going out to the countryside and living in a commune of people who you like and get along with, and trying to cull your desires to live as simply as possible so that what you get is easy to attain. So you get simple pleasures, which is different from the modern view of Epicureanism, and you have nice conversations. You pull out of society. And so it's hard for Epicureans to kind of go and be in the public sphere because they want to get out of the sphere because it causes them mental anguish for some reason. Who knows why? Maybe a quick click on Twitter will remind me. But So dealing with people can be stressful. And so Epicureans want to avoid that. Stoics in the ancient and modern world try to get involved, and it could be difficult at times. But the goal of Stoicism is to try to make the world a better place for your immediate sphere and the world in general. And so Stoics tend to go out more, and that may be part of why Stoicism is flourishing a little more. There are also some accidents of history that don't quite have to do with the religion component of why Stoicism became popular. It also fed into one of the most successful forms of therapy, or families of therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. It was an inspiration directly for that therapy. And as that got more into the public milieu, then Stoicism came up along with it. In terms of religion, the ancient Stoics kind of separated religion proper. They still did state functions and they worshiped the Roman gods as they were wont to do. And so that kind of can bring into the modern world where if people don't have religion, I think they could still be Stoic. But also if people have religion, I think for the most part, they can actually get along. And so Stoicism can appeal to a broader range of people with or without religion.
That's interesting because, again, we go back to this idea of the porch, whether in ancient Greece or in Selma, Alabama. People who may have a whole variety of different viewpoints can come together. They can BS, they can have fun, they can have conversations. Maybe an assumption of goodwill is embedded within all of that. But even what you're talking about with regards to Stoicism, that assumption of goodwill that's occurring on the porch, that everyone wants to at least make themselves better, hopefully the world a better place too, is almost, goes without saying, if we're gathering together for a purpose, it's a fundamentally positive orientation. And I could see why that might appeal, particularly in the United States, where positivism is so embedded in, and optimism is so embedded in our national character.
Yeah, at the same time, it may rub against it because a lot of Stoic practice involves you thinking about what bad things supposedly can happen in order to try to anticipate them and not be as harmed by them if they do arise. So Stoicism mindset and Stoic daily practice isn't really about thinking like being optimistic, but actually trying to be pessimistic about things that are outside of your control in the world at large, and then saying, even if things go wrong, I'm going to try to do the best
I can. We're going to talk about those issues on multiple fronts as this episode continues. I'm so glad you raised those. Thank you. But let's talk about a fun little exercise that I love to do with everybody. So, it could not be better that Stoicism has its origins in ancient Greek and Roman social thinking and in the particular time periods that they originated in, because as you and I discussed, and as those who are fans of the show know, I love to somehow find a way to tie everyone and everything into Greek mythology. So, we talked about this beforehand. You've got a mythical avatar or a mythical story that really speaks to you, and that might help us get to know you a little bit better, because we're going to talk about your own journey too as well. So share with us a mythological story or a mythological character that gets to your heart.
So yeah, the Stoics and the Greeks in general were really into their myths, and Romans as well. So there are a lot to choose from. I guess the one that I would probably go with is Medea, who was with Jason of the Argonauts fame. And she helped him out to do stuff. And then he took her out of her homeland and back with him and ultimately married her. And then after about 10 years of marriage, he dumped her and decided to marry somebody else and exiled her. And so that was painful for her. And so she decided to get revenge. And ultimately, part of her getting revenge was killing her own children so that Jason's heirs would be dead. And there's ancient play that is pretty heart-wrenching about Medea that survives. And there's also a Stoic wrote a play as well, Seneca, as well, about Medea. And Medea appears as an example of various sorts in throughout the Stoic literature. Sometimes it's negative and sometimes it's a positive. And so one of the things I wanted to highlight was the Stoic slave turned teacher, Epictetus, who was a teacher of Stoicism and who brought up Medea a few times in his teachings to other students. And the interesting thing about his take is that he paints Medea as an example on one hand of people losing their shit, so to speak, and the problems with certain emotions. But at the same time, he is actually quite forgiving of her and praises her in certain aspects. The fact that she was able to find fortitude, it's not like she cold-heartedly killed her children. She really struggled over this, but she's like, you know, I really need to get Jason back for what he did. So that is what she wound up doing. And so she found some fortitude in that, but also he paints a picture of why he uses her in one example in a lecture that is entitled Why We Shouldn't Get Angry at People or something like that. And he says we shouldn't be angry at Medea because she was doing what she thought was good. And this is a lesson that's taken up by other Stoics like the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, that people, and they get, this goes all the way back to Socrates, which the Stoics borrowed quite a bit from. And so this goes back to the idea that everybody who seems to be doing nasty things in the world, they're trying to act in what they think is good. And the problem is that they don't have a good enough idea of what is good. And one Stoic practice that Marcus Aurelius reminds us of is to also, when we get angry at other people, to remind ourselves of how we're similar that we're not perfect either. And so I haven't committed murder as far as I remember. If I were mad at Medea, if I got angry at the myth, I wouldn't be similar in that way. But have I ever wanted revenge? Of course. Do I still want revenge sometimes? Yes, it comes up. So I could remind myself, I have that in me too. And if there are people who I'm angry at, they're trying to do good and try to see their reasoning, and also remind myself that I'm the same way. And the goal of Stoic practice is to remember myths like these, look for what is positive as well as negative, and try to instill it in ourselves.
Couple of comments on this. First of all, just purely as a FYI, my personal mythical avatar is Helios, the ancient Greek god of the sun, who was Medea's father. And in fact, after she killed her children and basically destroyed Jason's life, I believe he loaned her a chariot. Maybe it was his chariot for her to escape unpunished. And so there is some metaphorical thinking there around the relationship between enlightenment, truth, which is also what the sun stood for in that time, and the act of revenge, as well as closing the loop on a dynasty. And the other thing about Medea that is fascinating, people tend to associate hero stories with the idea of being the hero as somehow a final destination. Heroism, at least in ancient myth, was a transitional state. The people were heroes on a journey, but then they always became something else afterwards, whether it was a king or they died and became an immortal in one way or another. And the reason why I mention this is because the end of the story about Jason, his transition, was that after Medea destroyed his children and his life was ruined by her, he ended up a beggar and died under his ship, the Argo, when it was rotting on a beach somewhere, and its prow just sort of fell off and hit him on the head, and that's what killed him. I mean, talk about a come down. And so there's also a metaphor in there, at least to me, of the power of revenge to bring comeuppance to someone who deserved it, who really did her wrong, and how it really ended a cycle of evil in a way. You have thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's actually one of the points that Epictetus brings up in his brief discussion of Medea, is that she was able to fortify herself against like the pain of killing her own children, but she was trying to do what she thought was the right thing. And that aspect is something that we can take with us without perhaps going into the murder route. If you're listening at home, don't worry, kids. I think that, and I really appreciate the way Epictetus brings her up is like the nuance, like the fact of forgiveness and the fact that she was really torn, and that you can look at people who you don't necessarily agree with or appreciate and still see things that you could admire about them. And she was in a really hellish situation. She left her homeland and went with this guy, and everything seemed to be going well. And then he just dumps her like that. So like, that's rough. You can see how that can be painful, and her actions make sense, and how she thought she was doing right. And in some sense may have been.
What you are talking about, both with regards to the Medea story and the Stoic principles that relate to it, go as to something that I feel contributes to the secret plague of alienation. And that is the tendency that we have, the world of big media, I personally think, plays into this, of telling only one side of the story and encouraging people who are watching or listening to news stories that we have to make these snap judgments, not necessarily be so reflective. And we therefore end up with a divided house, so to speak. People not wanting to come to grandma's porch anymore because they are isolated, because they are angry, because they've made a decision based on the whole story. Talk to me a little bit more, because this really was something that impacted me and got me thinking about the way I'm listening to and processing the news after I read your book. Talk to me about solutions to this and practice that you address in your book that might help people that are hearing this myth and this particular principle and saying, wait, I'm guilty of this all the time.
Yeah, I think one of the things I like about Stoicism is that there's no single answer or solution to the question. And we structured the book so that people tested different kinds of Stoic techniques. And then at the very end, we have people put together their own personalized curriculum based on that, if they can get that far, because it is because there's no single solution for everybody. If people have different strengths and weaknesses and problems, and so different things will work for different people, and different issues are more important to tackle for different people than others. And so in terms of like news and the media, there are at least two that I could think of. One is to try to just cut it out. And that doesn't mean, if you feel like it's just too much, either emotionally or it takes away from too many other things, or you practice habits you don't like, then cut it out. For me, I haven't posted on Facebook except for some private groups, but I haven't posted on my feed in 5-ish years because I barely post on Twitter just because I didn't like the practicing what it was making me do. It was kind of putting me in the star of the show and then coming back and looking for likes and stuff and then getting caught up in wanting to answer things. And so I don't think I am good at going like handling that. And so I cut it out. But I check it like once every couple of days. And so I'm at a good place where I still want to be in touch with the world a little bit, but I don't actually engage very heavily in social media. So like that is one solution, is just cutting it out, because it's overall harmful and a waste of time for some people sometimes, not everybody. But then they're also intentionally trying to go back into it. And so if you want to kind of practice trying to expand your boundaries, you can intentionally go back and post certain things on social media if you're fearful of exposure or what people would say, for instance. And so it could actually be transformed into a tool of use. If you want to expose yourself to a specific media outlet that you don't like or that you disagree with, you can make it a conscious exercise to go back to that news outlet and say, I'm going to read this for 10 minutes. I'm going to set a timer and I'm going to note what I think about this and my snap judgment specifically. For somebody who has the problem of having snap judgments, you could actually reintroduce yourself to that consciously and looking for the flaw that you want to mitigate and use it as a kind of gym, a training of sorts to say, I'm doing this for 10 minutes. I'm specifically looking at my snap judgments and I'm going to work with them by either shutting them up or maybe I can, maybe more usefully, I could generate an alternative hypothesis. So, oh, this media outlet is saying this thing I don't like. And clearly they're biased. Okay, that's one possibility. Let me generate one more. And by trying to generate alternative points of view, you can start to get in the habit and mental training of improving yourself and expanding your boundaries. So at the end of the day, how to tackle it depends on where you are and what your goals are. And even within Stoicism proper, which does have a single goal of becoming a better human being, there are several ways to tackle it depending on where you are and your specific strengths and weaknesses.
Let's keep it real here. You said something in passing that my little mind went right to, and I'm going to go back to it. When you talk about someone reading in, I would even say experiencing your book or participating in your book, I really viewed it as an interactive experience that I truly mean this was personally transformative. You said if they make it through or something to that effect. Why did you say that?
Because it's hard. I mean, it's a year long book. And my view of kind of the way most people try to look for salves in the modern world is somewhat pessimistic. Mm-hmm. And I got into Stoicism, I think, initially with a similar mindset as well. The idea is that there is a problem such as I have anxiety or I am not making enough money. Those are usually two big things. Or I am sad. I am lonely. And this is a problem that I need to cure. So let me find the correct salve to apply in order to feel better. And the goal there is kind of feeling better. And usually people kind of go for like quicker solutions. Like I will take five deep breaths. I will view something positively. And I don't think that helps too much in the long term, because a lot of these quick techniques, if they're constantly applied, maybe they can help, but they could also cause some harm. So like Stoicism is a little different in that its goal is not necessarily feeling better, though that is a side effect. But if one goes into Stoicism early on and tries just to feel better, Stoicism is doing the world a disservice, because if I do something wrong, maybe I should feel a little bad. And that's a form of regret that I could then say, okay, well, there's not, you know, if the past is the past and I can't, in lieu of inventing a time machine, I can't change it, but at least I could remind myself of what to do to go forward. And if things that I've done in the past come up again, I could remind myself what I plan to do to try to mitigate things in the future so that I don't repeat the same mistake. And, you know, sometimes I'll fail, but the goal is to succeed slightly more often with, you know, it's not going to be steady progress. There'll be up and downs. But overall, getting back to your original question, because I think transformative practice is a lifelong thing and it's hard. So we didn't write the book. At least I didn't. I don't know if I could speak for Massimo, thinking that 100% of people go through it. We gave some out so that people can take a look and just pick and choose some practices that they wanted to try, because we knew that there's going to be a variety of people who are going to come there. But ideally, the goal is it's a year-long training program just to select exercises if they do it as it was fully intended. And then it's a lifelong practice. And who's going to stick with that? Probably a minority.
Well, we're going to talk about this concept of lifelong practice in a second. But before we do that, I wanted to just express gratitude for you about one element of the book that you referenced earlier. Someone like me always feels a little bit of frustration when the ultimate reason why I should engage in a particular practice or follow someone's system for self-improvement is you'll feel better. And that you'll feel better or you'll be happier or whatever, it's almost just sort of thrown out there as if everyone under the sun is looking for that. Gregory, I personally don't care if I feel better. That's not what I'm about. I'm about fulfilling what I view as my life's purpose. Whether I feel good or not has nothing to do with anything. I was put on this earth for a reason. I intend to fulfill it to the best of my ability. And so the power of speaking to someone who is not necessarily just sitting around saying, I want to be happy, happy, happy. I want daisies and rainbows every day for the rest of my life, really impacted me. I can't be alone. I can't be the only person who is listening to the show, watching to the show, or who exists on the planet who isn't sitting around obsessed with personal happiness.
Yeah, I hope there are more and more of them. But at the same time, and happiness is a key word, because we kind of picture it as a kind of emotion or feeling. And that's not what we're aiming for. And I think it's still a little bit of an open question, because I actually practiced Buddhism and came to Buddhism before Stoicism, too. And one of the interesting things about early Buddhism is that you do practice a kind of meditation where you can get pleasure, because they're stipulating that the human mind wants some form of pleasure. And the goal is to replace a lower pleasure with higher pleasures. But yeah, like, and I can't say I should be interviewing you if I had the skills to interview, because you may be further ahead than I am, because I still do want like happiness in some degrees. But my goal is to, when the shit hits the fan, so to speak, to try my best to choose to do the right thing, even if it makes me unhappy in the emotional sense. And then also Stoicism teaches that you can work your beliefs and the way you frame situations is what's causing the emotion in the first place. So if I work with those, then I can mediate it, not for the goal of feeling better, but for the goal of getting my head on straight so I can act better. Ultimately, it's a precondition to doing better in the world. It's not, so you do feel better, but that's because emotions drive people to hurt themselves and other people, at least certain kinds of emotions, according to Stoicism. Not all emotions, but certain kinds do. And that's why the Stoics are concerned with emotions.
Going back yet again to your statements about the practice being hard. So one thing that I have contemplated a lot after reading your book in light of the themes of this show, and in saying what I'm about to say, I want to make it clear, so I'm not attacked down the road for this. I am not and do not pretend to be a subject matter expert in ancient Roman religious history or early Christian history. So I predicate what I'm about to say with that caveat out there. However, I have read that one of the appeals of Christianity in particular to the Roman elite that led the conversion of that empire to Christianity was that it had this emphasis on forgiveness. And the forgiveness could occur anytime before you died and after you atoned. And so this emphasis on forgiveness actually was appealing to people like emperors that were going around murdering people. They could just say, okay, let me murder so-and-so-and-so-and-so. I'll say forgiveness before I die, and I'll still end up in heaven. And I couldn't help but think this has primed us from a moral perspective away from the idea of self-discipline as a tie-in to our ethical obligations. Because if we can be forgiven for our sins, no matter when we commit them, so long as it's before that exact moment of death, and some people even say it happens as you're dying, then why engage in any sort of disciplined ethical practice at all? And so the question I have for you about that is, and you can agree or disagree, or you can choose to ignore it if you choose, but the question I have that it leads to is, do you think that our culture can even handle this at all? Are we primed away from it with what I might call an ethical laziness to such a degree that pushing Stoicism out is really just an exercise in talking to five people in a room of 10 million?
Probably.
Love your candor.
And yeah, I think that most people won't. This isn't a new problem, though. The Stoic teacher Epictetus said early, like during his days, if most of his students looked at themselves, they would be Epicurean. They want to get out of Dodge. They want to retire and live the good life and just sit back and have quiet. And he said a minority of the students sitting there are actually Stoics. And that's the Stoic teacher speaking to supposedly Stoics in training during the olden times where they knew what they were talking about. So, I don't think this is a new problem. Stoicism has always been a minority kind of philosophy. A lot of people did pick it up, but as for whether we're just beyond able to do anything. Maybe, maybe not. I do suspect that it will always be a minority. And I believe that people who are out there publicly like myself will also not be necessarily paragons of virtue all the time either. But fortunately, one of the interesting things about Stoicism is that they never claim there has been no Stoic throughout history who ever claimed to be a perfect Stoic, an enlightened Stoic. They called this the sage, and they said that the sage either didn't exist or was as rare as the phoenix. So the Stoics claim there is nobody or very few people ever who are perfect. And that is, in a sense, it's comforting because that means that improvement is good enough, that you don't have to get to full enlightenment in order to find benefit. So as far as, yeah, I think going around, I keep on making a joke sometimes that, you know, on the Amazon factory floor, they start having mindfulness booths so that you could take a break from your crappy conditions in order to gain some inner peace. And I make a joke that in 10 years, they may be Stoic negative visualization booths where they can sit down and imagine like how much worse it could be, and then they'll feel better, and then they could go back to packing boxes and peeing into jars that they carry with them because they can't take breaks. So like that's, I suspect that that is a plausible way things will go. But the thing is, that's outside of my control. The best I can do is use what I think I can do to tell some people about it, and maybe some people will pick it up a little bit, and that's fine.
Well, and these negative visualization booths that you just talked about, although it sounds laughable, again, because it's kind of against our national character, it's actually not so crazy. For instance, one of the things that I got better at while reading your book was having that bird's eye view of the problems that I was facing. Let's keep it real here. We have had people have, and I'm not asking you to comment on this unless you want to. We have had people in the past 2 years that I'm sure will be studied for a long time who have had extreme reactions to the idea of wearing a mask. That may be the most dramatic and horrifying thing that they've experienced in their lives. But let's face it, if you were living during the Black Death, it was kind of worse. And so even as pandemics go, this has not been good. I don't want to pretend that it has been some airy-fairy wonderful experience, but it hasn't been the worst thing, even from a pandemic perspective, that the world has faced. And remembering that larger perspective actually really has helped me manage. It really has.
Yeah, I agree. I think the larger perspective does kind of help. That's one of the Stoic exercises, to apply that selectively to give you the broad picture of that people have faced similar things that you're currently facing right now. And I agree that the negative reaction over masks seems overblown, but it's also a Stoic exercise to say, what kind of beliefs would they have to that make sense of these behaviors? And if they really think that this is like a pattern for oppression from the government, and this is just one more step of the government overstepping, and soon we'll lose all our freedoms, I could understand their view. I ultimately disagree with it, but part of the Stoic exercise is a constant thing, is to always turn it back on myself. Like, do I hold anything that, like, would I behave similarly if I believed it? Maybe. Like, if I was really thought I was standing up for freedom, and if I was brave enough, in a sense, I could do the Medea trick and say, like, these people are actually brave, because I don't know if I have the cojones to stand up and, you know, be kicked off a plane or get arrested or whatever for taking off my mask if I really thought of it as oppression. I personally don't, but I could see where it's coming from. And so one of the Stoic things that I try to do is to not use it as a philosophy to judge others with. Most of ethics, and I have a problem with a lot of modern ethics because it seems to be designed as a stick to beat other people with. It's like, is this person good or bad? Is this action good or bad? Well, I mean, I've spent most of my life doing that kind of stuff, and it's about time I want to try to turn that around to stop a little bit, because I could also use ethics to try to improve myself. And that's where I have more control compared to what other people are doing.
And look, man, that whole idea of not knowing the whole story and acknowledging that is big. And even with the mask drama that has happened throughout the Western world, America in particular, you don't know the whole story. You don't know when you're talking to someone, for instance, for all, what was their childhood like? What sort of experiences did they have? Where are they from? Are they even from the United States? Maybe they're from a country where, and they've immigrated here to the U.S., where these things really were the first step down a slippery slope, and they know what it's like to live under tyranny. And that stepping back, having some honesty about our limitations, that's a hard thing to engage. And we talked a little bit earlier about this being hard. That's a hard, to, especially in a busy society like ours, where there's a lot of distractions. You mentioned social media just being one of a million. To take that moment and say, how can I sit and think about what the other perspective might be?
Yeah, it's hard. And I think the biggest failure, I mean, the ways in which I fail the most, I think the most common one is forgetting. Mm. That is like, you know, you go about your day, you do your job, you clean the house, you go shopping for groceries, you do your thing, you hang out with family, and just, you know, oh, I forgot about the practice. It wasn't even been on my mind. And so when something comes up, I'm not prepared to get it. And I think, like, although they're like our bigger, I guess, bigger emotional impact failures, they're a lot more rare. The biggest one is just forgetting. Mm. And the distractions in the modern world make it a lot easier. Like, I get up in the morning and flick through my phone for a little bit. And I'm not saying, I haven't made a conscious decision like, oh, now what is the best use of my time right now? Okay, I think I will flick through and check my emails. And then I think I will check through it a second time after checking the news. It just happens. And so forgetting is the biggest way in which the practice is hard. And so the antidote, which I try to do, is various ways of remembering and just, you know, surrounding myself, like leading New York City Stoics groups and doing Stoic reading and talking to people who are going through similar things that reminds me faintly, but enough so that I can try to improve in that arena. But it's still a majority of the time where I go through my life sleepwalking.
If there's one really valuable takeaway from this part of the episode, I think the importance of remembering to not forget might be it. That's powerful.
Well, Gregory, it has been great taking a ride with you today. Thank you so much for joining us. And for everyone tuning in, you should know that this is just the first of a two-part interview with Gregory. Next time, he's gonna rev up and take another race with me down the Purpose Highway. We're gonna discuss what we can really control in life and what that means for how we live it. We're gonna talk about the role of luck and ethical living. And we're gonna share the relationship between passion and our very humanity. It is going to be an incredible experience. If you like this episode, please be sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple or a comment on YouTube. And I shall see you next time for another trip down the Purpose Highway. When you're racing down the Purpose Highway, we want to make sure you're healthy and happy every step of the way. That's why we're proud to partner with It's Nola, 21st century plant-based healthy granola snack bites made with real ingredients and audacious flavor. It's Nola crafts small batch hand-rolled granola balls that are vegan, gluten-free, and naturally low in sugar. It's Nola's delightful bites come in three flavors: luscious cranberry coconut, sassy mango masala, and dark, decadent, chewy chocolate. It's Nola is available to both individual customers and for wholesale accounts at itsnola.com. That's itsnola.com. Guests on this show are already enjoying this delicious snack. Check out It's Nola's website for yourself and find out how good it is.